from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. January 28, 2003, in his State of the Union address, President Bush told the nation that Saddam Hussein had recently sought significant quantities of uranium in Africa. The Mushroom Cloud, WMD, nuclear threat was in play. 8 weeks later, America was at war. The problem was the nuclear charge wasn't true. When a former U.S. ambassador said so, the White House came down on him like a ton of bricks. Yesterday, Vice President Dick Cheney's then Chief of Staff Scooter Libby faced the music with felony convictions on perjury, lying, obstruction of justice. But the one talking juror asked, "Where are the other guys?" Up next on Point, the day after the Libby verdict, what now? Joining us today from Washington is Michael Isikoff, award-winning investigative reporter for Newsweek magazine. He covered the eight-week Libby trial. He's the co-author of Hubris, The Inside Story of Spin, Scandal, and the Selling of the Iraq War. Michael Isikoff, good to have you. Thanks for being here.
Good to be with you.
And we're joined in this hour by Jonathan Turley, legal scholar at George Washington University and a USA Today contributor. Jonathan Turley, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you very much.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Jack, good to have you.
Hello, Tom, Michael, and Jonathan.
Michael Isikoff, first to you. You covered this trial. A lot of us saw a lot of how it came down yesterday. Just give us a sense of what you read in the drama first of Libby taking this, Libby's wife, the Fitzgerald.
Yeah, it was
and the
a
rest.
Pretty dramatic scene in the courtroom. I suppose it always is when you get a big trial and jury's out for a long time, and there's genuine uncertainty about what the verdict is going to be. It's a moment of reckoning, and it is a pretty gripping scene to be there in a courtroom like that. I think that you're watching closely when Libby and his lawyers walked into the courtroom at noon yesterday, they pretty much, you could see in their faces, they feared the worst. The last couple of notes from the jurors had all been about count three, which was the weakest count in the indictment. It revolved around whether Libby made false statements about his conversation with Matt Cooper. And it was and the fact that the jurors were hung up on the weakest count and asking for clarification is kind of left you with the feeling that they probably, if they were hung up on the weaker count, they probably had reached a verdict on the stronger counts. So when Libby walks in, I mean, he throughout the trial, he was a pretty cool cucumber, chipper, smiled a lot, whispered, totally at ease. You could tell in his face that was no longer the case, that he just sat down, he was stoic, he was impassive. His defense, the top defense lawyer, Ted Wells, was grim, staring at his notepad, seemed to be doodling some notes on a notepad. You could sense that they knew, they feared the worst. And then when the verdict came, the jury came in, it came pretty swiftly. Guilty on four counts. His wife, Scooter Libby's wife, who had been sitting in the front row throughout the trial and be very much part of the defense team, sort of broke down. She was shaking. She was in tears. Afterwards, she went up and hugged each of the defense lawyers. It was a very emotional scene. And it is, whatever. I mean, you're looking at the end of the day at a human being. He's a father. He's got kids. He's got a family. He's a real man. And he's now a convicted felon who's facing having to go to prison.
Jonathan Turley, will he go to prison? And for how long? Sentencing June 5th, we're told, but the word pardon is flying around. The president's not talking about it, but it could happen any time. Do you think this man will serve prison time? There's also an appeal out there, of course. But what are the odds that Scooter Libby will sit in prison?
I think the odds are very likely that he will be sentenced to prison. Under the sentencing guidelines, he would get probably somewhere between 1.5 and 3 years.
Out of the potential 25.
That's right. And this is the type of defendant that courts generally do send to prison to avoid any appearance of special treatment for white-collar criminals or high-placed officials. As for the pardon, it puts the president in a rather odd position. You know, he's been criticized for being quite miserly about pardons. He's given fewer pardons than most modern presidents. He certainly kept that record of low pardons from being governor in Texas. So from now to give a rather uncharacteristic pardon to Libby will magnify the controversy. So I do think that Libby has a great advocate for pardon in the body of Vice President Cheney. And certainly Cheney doesn't fear being more unpopular. He's almost statistically impossible to get more unpopular where he is in the polls, and this is a very good friend of his. The way this usually happens in Washington is they let the guy go to prison for a little while, and then they pardon him at the end of the term. That's if it follows the conventional pattern.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the president can look to his father, who pardoned the Iran-Contra defendants, as some precedent in this area.
So if they play it out in that scenario, Libby might not it could be a long time before he actually goes through a prison gate, pretty near to the president's time of leaving office.
Well, if they follow the conventional pattern, he would go to jail. Usually the defendant goes to jail while the appeal is proceeding. My guess is the judge will make fast work out of the motion for a new trial. I don't see any really good basis to bring a new trial in this case. I actually don't see many strong appellate issues either. The problem for Libby is that these types of criminal charges turn on the credibility of witnesses. These are the ultimate fact questions that go up on appeal. Those types of questions are given great deference by the Court of Appeals. You cannot overturn those types of decisions unless they're just clearly erroneous, and that does not appear to be the case here. Nine people basically said Libby was a liar. And
11, actually.
Well, yeah, if you count, I suppose you can count up to 11. And that makes it pretty armor-plated.
11 jurors, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
He's a liar.
You know, there's a lot to look at here. Jack Beatty, let me just put this to you, though. Here we are as the headlines come out, and there's a tone change. I mean, it's been coming. It's not entirely new. But now you've got Associated Press on this story talking about the Bush administration calling it a presidency under siege. You've got the Washington Post calling this the beleaguered Bush presidency. I mean, as Jonathan Turley says, the polls haven't been good for a long time. But does this tip the administration to some new phase, Jack?
Well, it could. I mean, to me, the words of the day weren't said at that courthouse, but rather on Capitol Hill when one of the fired U.S. attorneys said he felt sick about being pressured by Republican lawmakers to indict a Democrat. I think that's how many Americans feel about this whole Libby case. They're sick. That, you know, that a vice president's chief of staff should obstruct justice. Sick that he did it to protect his unworthy boss. Sick that Cheney got off scot-free. Sick that Rove only escaped prosecution, as I understand it, through the testimony of a journalist whose husband got appointed to a high government post as quid pro quo. Sick, you know, that high elected officials connived at the outing of a CIA operative to discredit her husband for telling the truth about their lies, the lies that got us into this morally grim war. You know, Cheney famously said that to defeat al-Qaeda, the U.S. would operate on the dark side.
Mm.
Now we know what he meant. The administration would torture, would spread disinformation, would illegally wiretap, would shred the Constitution, scrapping habeas corpus rights 900 years old, and would direct one of its minions to dishonor himself and really disgrace the country by lying under oath to cover the vice president's rear end. Americans are sick of the dark side and of the dark and devious men who took America there.
Jack, I guess we see where you stand on this. Michael Isikoff, is this the end of it? Does it go further? There was a lot of talk, you know, he's the fall guy, and why didn't we see Roe?
In terms of the Patrick Fitzgerald's criminal investigation,
yeah.
Yes, it is the end, and he made that pretty clear on the courthouse steps yesterday, Fitzgerald. There's no further there are no further charges he's going to bring. There's no going up the chain. He's not going to be looking to flip Libby to get him to testify against Cheney because there's no prospect that's going to happen anyway. He wants to go back to what he called his day job. But it is interesting, you know, Jack mentioned the U.S. attorneys who testified yesterday. I actually was at the hearing for at those U.S. attorneys.
Mostly Republican, all fired.
The run down to the courthouse that there was a verdict in the Libby trial.
Yeah.
And I, you know, if this case shows anything,
It shows the power of a completely independent federal prosecutor who operates without concern for you know, political implications or how your or press coverage. Whatever you say about the Patrick Fitzgerald's decision to bring this case, it was clearly a decision that could have gone the other way. And a lot of people, a lot of critics are arguing that this, since there was no underlying crime here, he didn't charge the underlying offense of leaking the identity of a covert CIA agent, he shouldn't have brought the case. And that's going to be part of the grounds for people arguing he should be pardoned. So he made a judgment call. And there are a lot of, you know, I think many people, if you take a step back, remember Fitzgerald was named a special counsel. If he had not been, then a U.S. attorney, probably in the District of Columbia, where the case began, would have had to gone to political appointees in the Justice Department right. and gone the usual process. And it is clearly debatable whether this case ever would have gone as far as it did.
Let's listen for just a moment to Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald speaking with reporters after the verdict yesterday.
Obviously, we are gratified by the jury's verdict today. The jury worked very long and hard and deliberated at some length over the charges and returned a verdict of guilty on four of the counts. The jury was obviously convinced beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant had lied and obstructed justice in a serious manner. The results are actually sad. It's sad that we had a situation where a high-level official, a person who worked in the office of vice president, obstructed justice and lied under oath. We wish that it not had happened, but it did.
Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald there speaking yesterday after the verdict. There's the judicial system in train. There are politics here, too, and expectations here. Senate Majority Leader Democrat Harry Reid challenging President Bush yesterday to live up to his word, as he said, that he would get to the bottom of how the original leak happened.
I think it needs a shift to the White House now. Shift to the White House and find out what the president's going to do about this. He said in the past that anyone who was a leaker would be relieved of duty in the White House. He should follow through on that now because we have sworn testimony that there were people within the White House in addition to Libby who were leaking information.
Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid yesterday after the verdict. I want to turn right now to Dick Armey, former Republican congressman from Texas, served as House Majority Leader, Republican from 95 to 2003. He's chairman of the think tank Freedom Works. Dick Armey, thanks very much for being with us. What do you make of the Scooter Libby verdict, sir?
Well, of course, the first thing I observe is going way back to Watergate. Politicians get themselves in trouble most often as a result of having done something that didn't need to have been done. It was just it was just a silly, vendetta sort of thing. I don't know, it was ridiculous to have gotten involved in that whole process in the first place. And then secondly, it's generally not what the underlying perpetration that results in somebody getting nailed. It's the cover-up. So my view is that Scooter Libby will probably try an appeals process that'll fail. I believe that he will receive a sentence. I think he'll serve it, and I do not believe he'll be pardoned. So what I would suggest is that the Democrats should probably give themselves a little self-respect and acknowledge the possibility that he might have something more important to do than just politically hammer on the White House and this and turn their attention to more important things. And I think it's even more important that the White House start turning its attention to serious matters of public policy that confront this country. I think we need to look at this and say, all right, this is a seamy affair that shows how small people in public office can be, but it's over now. The guy will do his time. Let's get done with it. And let's get on to more important matters.
What about at the White House level? I mean, you say it's silly, and, you know, certainly we saw some silly things here, but others are saying, well, maybe what we had here was a kind of fundamental, a kind of corruption of the public discourse around taking the nation to war, a war that's turned out pretty badly here. Do you see self-examination coming in the White House sufficient to deal with that, or does it need attention from outside?
Well, again, I mean, this spat's so far in the fire, and, you know, my own position on this decision to invade Iraq is well documented, but the fact of the matter is, again, we need to get past that. We need to find a way. How do we resolve this dilemma? How do we get out of there with some self-respect, leaving something other than just abject turmoil behind us? Let's resolve this issue. But the fact of the matter is, because we've been so embroiled in all that attaches to the decision to invade Iraq, we have neglected many very important public policy issues, and it needs, I think, Congress and the President, they need to get beyond, past politics, for the Lord have mercy, just for a while. Can they put politics aside and get down to the serious work of this country?
Dick Harmon, let me put this to our legal scholar, Jonathan Turley, for a minute. Jonathan, what about as a legal scholar? Does it look to you like the country needs to get past the path into this war, which is really what this is about? Or, you know, was there something that got fundamentally out of whack that allowed the country to go to war in this way that we've got to go back and fix?
Well, I do think that there remains unresolved issues with this trial. I think you sense that from the jurors and the public. And when it comes to the war, we're talking about the most serious decision that Congress can make. And it's clear that not only did we go to war on false intelligence, but there were people in the government who knew that the intelligence is either false or highly unreliable. That's as important a decision as can be made by a president and his vice president. And what we see with this trial is the first glimpse within the White House. This is a White House that's pathologically secret. And we really saw that when the Wilson article hit the stands, Cheney saw immediately what it represented, that this was a whistle coming down the track. They had not found the weapons of mass destruction. But the response was quite wrathful, and it was very comprehensive. Now, one of the concerns many people have is that Scooter Libby is not some rogue employee. I mean, he was viewed in this town as the button guy for Dick Cheney. And really, many people are wondering how this trial resolves these many questions, and in reality, it doesn't. There has not been a resolution or accountability for what may be the greatest and most colossal mistake in modern American history, going to war in a preemptive strike based on false intelligence.
Well, the Wall Street Journal editorial today, conservative editorial board there, just says this is just criminalizing political differences, is what they've said all along. It's a travesty of justice, Jonathan.
Well, you know, it's not politicalization of these issues. I mean, this is an inside look into Washington, and all of us know it, and it's not pretty. I mean, this is a typical Washington morality play where there are no redeeming characters, and everyone from journalists to presidents and vice presidents are acting extremely badly. But it's more than that. You had nine witnesses who said, basically, this guy lied, and he was lying about something enormously important. But there's no question that this will be treated as, well, this is just another leak job. But, for example, one of the most embarrassing things to come out of this trial is that when the president was going out and saying how appalling it was that people were leaking and how he wanted the heads of any leakers, this trial investigation revealed that he himself had leaked, that during the same period he went right back into the Oval Office and leaked. He later called it a declassification.
A national intelligence estimate.
Yeah, it was a declassification that was not known to the director of the CIA, the Secretary of Defense. It was a leak.
I've got to turn to Dick Harmon and Michael.
And all due respect to your legal scholarship
here,
no less a prominent American liberal than Willie Nelson has the word on this. He's got a great song called There's Nothing I Can Do About It Now. We can sit around and wallow in all this stuff until hell freezes over. But the fact is, this president will be in office for the duration of his term. We have very important matters before this country.
The boys are dying and girls now, too, in Iraq.
I understand. That's why the attention should not be how did we get into this, but how do we get out of it? How do we get those young men and women out of there safely?
How do we allow
them to complete a mission? We're focusing, and I got to tell you this.
Yes.
A continued focus on this is politics. It's not about America. It's not about the future. It's about assigning blame in the past.
Have Republicans learned a lesson then, looking forward? Have they learned a lesson?
No, politicians never seem to learn a lesson. Look, we have all kinds of unresolved transgressions of the Clinton administration, and a lot of our academic liberals are happy to let that go to rest. Let it be. Let it die. Let it lay rotten in its filthy grave, and let's get on to this nation's serious, important business.
Let it be, says Dick Armey, former House Majority Leader in the GOP. Dick Armey, thank you very much for joining us today.
You bet.
Michael Isikoff, I know we have to let you go as well. A final thought from you on where you think this sets Washington now. Harry Reid says, shift to the White House. Dick Armey says, let it be. What do you think comes next?
Well, I don't think either the Democratic Congress or the country at the end is going to let the entire issue of the Iraq War, of the origins of the Iraq War, be, because it's a major part of our history. And the worse things get in Iraq, and things have gotten pretty bleak, the more people look back on the events of 2002 in 2003 and say, how did we get into this mess? By the way, Dick Armey comes to this with some fairly clean hands, as we show in Hubris. You know, Armey was actually one of the guys in the top of the Republican leadership who was speaking up, raising really questions, but he did it quietly behind closed doors. After briefly making one comment in Iowa in August of 2002, he kept his mouth shut and went along at the end, but he did at least go a lot further than some major Democrats did in raising questions about how we got into this mess.
And we hear from him today. Michael Isikoff at Newsweek magazine covered the trial. Michael, thank you for joining us today.
Sure enough. Thanks.
Let me go to our callers. John in Tallahassee, Florida. John, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I listen to talk radio and talk TV, which is all right-wing, and the same right-wing guys who say they're all about law and order are the ones who are howling injustice and howling about a pardon. Like, and if Bush ever gave this guy a pardon, not only would it be a huge travesty of justice, but I think in my mind it would remove any doubt whatsoever that this administration is corrupt from the top down.
But you know, you hear the Wall Street Journal saying, well, this is just criminalizing politics, John.
Well, they tried to impeach Clinton for fooling around behind his wife's back. This guy lied and obstructed justice in order to protect the vice president's backside. I think that is the epitome of hypocrisy.
John in Tallahassee, thanks for that. Jack Beatty, how about it? The pardon possibility, the politics around it. You've got Republican presidential candidates who don't want to be, you know, tarred with that by a fellow Republican. If that's the way it looks, how do you think this may unfold? Dick Cheney has some no small influence on George Bush, who holds the pardon pen.
Well, someone has conjectured that if he pardons him, it'll be an admission that in fact, he did take a bullet for the administration. But that'll only confirm what anyone of sense has to see here. And, you know, I think finally our caller raises the issue of accountability. Bill Clinton was impeached for a very minor offense, lying under oath in a deposition. The vice president consistently lied, I think lied is the correct word, about the connections between al-Qaeda and Saddam. He lied about the weapons of mass destruction, as we know. He said things that if he didn't know they weren't true, that was irresponsible. And yet no one is talking about his impeachment.
Dick Armey says, let it be in its filthy, rotten grave.
We have a system here of accountability. It's like a message to the future. It's like we hold ourselves to these high standards. And when an administration and officials in it violate those standards with impunity or get medals of freedom for the job, then something is very wrong. A whole system of sort of moral balancing and checks and balances is thrown out. And it's almost as if the body politic needs to be rebalanced. And it's not being rebalanced here with any sort of accountability when someone as low as this. You know, this is tantamount, really, to Lindy England going to the brig for Abu Ghraib. This is that sort of thing.
I'm not sure Scooter Libby's pride would go with that parallel, but we hear it. We're looking at the Scooter Libby verdict the day after. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I want to turn now to Washington and Ken Walsh, chief Washington correspondent for U.S. News and World Report. Ken, thank you for being with us. Where do you see this going now? Harry Reid says, shift to the White House. We just heard Dick Armey say, let it be. Practically, where do you think this goes, if anywhere, Ken?
Well, I think that the Democrats certainly will make as much of this as they can, and I think that the legal part is one thing, and then what Congress can do is another. And the special prosecutor says that this is over now, and he has no more role in investigating or pursuing this. So now it's gone totally to the political realm. And I mean, I see this in a larger context in that the beginning of the war in Iraq now has been dealt a devastating blow in many ways, including through the Scooter Libby verdict, in which we now see all the machinations that went on to distort the information about what was the weapons of mass destruction, but also to try to cast doubt on the critics of the war. And also now we have at the end of the process this Walter Reed Medical Center fiasco, where the returning veterans are now seen to be getting shoddy care there, and we have this big commission investigating and so on. So I think there's one issue after another now raising big questions, even more questions than we've had about the Iraq War. And I think that's what the Democrats are trying to do, tie all this together in a number of ways. And so we're not sure exactly how the Democrats are going to do this. You know, I'm sure there'll be further hearings and so on, but you know, they're not organized as with as much discipline as they might be. So you know, you can never be sure how this is going to be pursued. But certainly, the leadership in the House and Senate are looking for ways to keep this issue alive and to look at Cheney's role and so on. But
yep. No doubt. Let me ask you, Jonathan Turley. Jack Beatty says Clinton was brought up on impeachment charges on a far less serious matter than war. What about Dick Cheney, Jonathan?
Well, as you know, I supported the Clinton impeachment. I thought that he justifiably was impeached. The difference between the Clinton case and the Cheney case is that Cheney is making statements, probably statements he should not have made, about these connections, but he can certainly argue that this was really part of his official duties and that he had reached these conclusions. Now, you're allowed to be stupid, even reckless, in the office of the president or vice president. We've certainly proven that historically.
What if he knew or had reason to believe they weren't true? What if it wasn't stupidity or recklessness, but like a deliberate misrepresentation?
Does it matter in that form? Yeah, even then, it probably is not an impeachable offense unless you can tie it to sworn statements or some other collateral, you know, aspect. I think that it's unlikely that you could make out an impeachment case about Cheney with what we know right now. The concern among many people is that what we know may not be all that's there. You know, there was great criticism, including, I must admit, for me, about this investigation and how it treated Cheney and Rove. The investigation was extremely light on Cheney. Whenever it got close to Cheney, the light seemed to go off. Many times they wouldn't even refer to him by name. He was not called to the grand jury. Rove was given numerous opportunities to correct his testimony. I mean, the investigation seemed from the very beginning to steer away from Cheney and Rove.
Let's listen to a couple of pieces of tape from yesterday. First, White House spokeswoman Dana Perino issuing this carefully worded statement after the verdict.
The president was informed by, he was in the Oval Office. He saw the verdict read on television. He said that he respected the jury's verdict, that he was saddened for Scooter Libby and his family, and that the White House direction from here on out, and I know that there's going to be a lot of disappointment with this, but there is an ongoing criminal proceeding. Scooter Libby's attorneys just announced that they are going to ask for a new trial and that they are going to, failing that, they would appeal the verdict. And so our principled stand of not commenting on an ongoing legal investigation is going to continue.
White House spokesman Dana Perino on the White House's principled stand. Here's Democratic National Committee Chairman Howard Dean telling CNN's Wolf Blitzer that Scooter Libby now has incentive to tell, as Dean said, what else is going on in the vice president's office. He said for that reason, the president should not pardon Cheney's former chief of staff.
Don't forget, this is the tip of the iceberg. This is about the president and the vice president trying to discredit people who turned out to be right about the war in Iraq. Scooter Libby didn't do this all by himself. The best way that the president has to shut Scooter Libby up before sentencing is to pardon him. I hope that will not happen. I think we need to find out what really did happen when the CIA gave the president reports that said that not to trust some of their sources in Iraq. There's a lot more going on here than just this.
Howard Dean yesterday on CNN. Ken Walsh is with us, Jonathan Turley and Jack Beatty right now. Ken is calling from Boston. Hi, Ken, you're on the air.
Hello, gentlemen. I just wanted to comment to say that, one, Jack, I thought that your portrayal at the start of the segment was an elegant portrayal. And I do think that the Democrats should move on and take care of the nation's business, as Dick Armey has described. However, I think that they should take up the matter later if given the opportunity and pursue these matters. I mean, after all, we've got young men and women who have subscribed to this war and all of the depictions of the weapons of mass destruction that we were told that Iraq had. And I think that you know, for the honor of those men and women who are giving up their lives for us,
take it up later. Like when, Ken? When the Bush team is gone? When after the next presidential? When the war's over? Whenever that is, take it up when?
Yes, yes, precisely. After the Bush administration has left office.
Okay, we got it, Jack. What do you say? Wait.
Wait. Well, you know, effectively, that may be where we are. I mean, the Democrats, Jonathan says, impeachment isn't even a legal possibility. Although I did not think President Clinton should have been impeached. And it occurred to me that impeachment is a political matter, strictly. However, they have no will to impeach the vice president, much less the president. So I don't know that there's going to be any more political, the political branch I don't see doing any more on this than perhaps stirring it around and making yet more trouble. And according to Mr. Fitzgerald, the legal part of it is closed off. So it may well be that Ken is right, that it will be after, and it will be the historians who will finally get to the records and sort this out.
Ken Walsh, how about it? What do you read in the Democrats now? Can you see them mounting some, you know, further big campaign to pursue this? Or are they going to, for whatever reasons, political or urgent reasons of urgency, turn their attention elsewhere? You heard Howard Dean right there.
Exactly. Well, of course, he's the party chairman. He doesn't have a heck of a lot to do about what the leadership in Congress does. But, I think it's more likely that the House, with their many different committee and subcommittee chairmen who now have power and subpoena power, might look into this. I don't think the Senate will. I think the House is much more aggressive in these sorts of things. But, you know, they have so many other things on their plate, the leading one being, how do they get out of Iraq? And I think that to spend time on this doesn't strike me as something that they're about to do and something that that will lead them down any fruitful avenues.
But there is a presidential campaign coming. In addition to issues of justice and setting the record straight, I mean, do you think they see leverage in this around the presidential campaign and a Democrat's prospects?
Sure. Oh, sure. Well, if you look at the comments that came out initially about the verdict, I thought the Hillary Clinton's comments were actually, as she's trying to do these days, quite cautious. Somebody like John Edwards and Barack Obama were, I think, more vigorous in talking about where this trail goes and looking at the vice president and Rove and beyond. But I think that as far as what the Congress can do now, as with we're finding in so many other areas, unless you have a bigger majority than the Democrats have and unless they're more united, I just don't see them going very far with this. Certainly looking into the this whole Libby situation and where it ended, I just think that it's not something they're going to do right now. Down the line, I think that's even less likely. I think that it's just this idea of historians looking into it, absolutely, that'll happen. Maybe you'll have some media investigations in addition, but it's very hard to pry anything out of this White House right now, and I think the Democrats realize that.
Baton to historians, perhaps. Let's take a call from Ames, Iowa. Walter, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I was calling to take exception to what Dick Armey said. Your previous caller was agreeing but saying put it off. And I say there's too much of this. Things get put off all the time. And what we need is leadership. We need openness and honesty from our leadership and people to just sort these things out and get them right and then move on. If we put them off, things just sort of drift away and they don't have the seriousness that needs to be applied.
Let us pick it up. Jonathan Turley, you hear what Walter has to say. You know, what about it? As a constitutional scholar, a legal scholar, do you see a problem that needs addressing? Is it something beyond the Iraq War itself? Is it in the manner in which this executive, you know, has conceived its powers and used them? Is there something there that, in your view, needs to be addressed?
Well, I think Walter's absolutely correct. I was disappointed with Dick Armey's comments. That's always the answer of politicians in Washington. It's always, well, let's just deal with this and move on. And it's Democrats and Republicans. I mean, you see Democrats jumping up and down about all the abuses, the Iraq War, that they voted for, and they refused to listen to people at the time, that they should not have given the president the blank check that they gave him. And so it's all part of scandal management, and this is the center of the universe for that particular form of art. There is indeed a great reason why we should proceed and look at these issues. You know, for example, while we were talking about Dick Cheney and impeachment, I think it would be hard to come up with an argument to impeach Dick Cheney with what we have. It doesn't mean that there's not more there. There is, in fact, in my view, grounds to impeach President Bush. I think that President Bush has clearly committed crimes in office with regard to things like the electronic surveillance program and other programs that violate federal statutes. But there is indeed no will in Congress to take on those types of actions. And I think it would be a disappointment to many framers that you can have a nation go to war on false intelligence, do a preemptive strike, violate federal statutes, a president who said in the State of the Union that he intended to continue that program regardless of the view of Congress. That would have come as a great surprise to many framers because they thought that they had created a system of powerful checks and balances that has largely been offline for the last 4 years.
So do you think, though, that this verdict may be enough, even if in those terms it seems too small bore or too nuanced? Might this be the thing anyway that self-corrects the system? Or do you still see executive powers redefined and run amok?
No, indeed. I think that the Libby case so far has been a great example of crisis management. It's contained. When Karl Rove was allowed endless opportunities to change his testimony, when Cheney was not brought to the grand jury, at that point it was clear that this crisis could be managed. That doesn't mean it's not going to continue to bleed the White House in terms of popularity, but I do not think that this town learned anything from this case. I promise you, leaks will continue. They will flow like a powerful stream. And this sort of dishonest and hypocritical treatment of this case, I think, shows that this is a city that does not learn from its mistakes. It simply manages them.
Jack, do you see self-correction underway here, even in the relatively modest steps we've seen in the last 24 hours?
Well, I think one possible self-correction, I think this further discredits Cheney within the administration. This makes him more toxic even than he has been. Stories have come out that there's distance growing between him and the president, that his range of bad advice over a whole a whole number of issues has finally come home to the president. And if this marginalizes him in giving advice, say, about Iran, or North Korea, or which he tried to, a deal that he certainly doesn't approve of, the possible deal we could have with North Korea, and he has remarked about the mullahs in Iran, you know, someone as Washington Post paraphrased him as saying he wants them dead. Well, if he can be marginalized within the administration and with the president, I think that could be for the good.
But that's still around the issue of Iraq itself. Ken Walsh, what about this sort of notion of the unitary executive, the imperial presidency, the re-empowered presidency? Do you see that losing any altitude in the face of everything that's flying at it here, including the Libby verdict?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, Cheney, I have actually interviewed Cheney about this some time ago, about last year, but he developed these views about the unitary presidency, the unitary executive, mm-hmm. long ago, and back when he was chief of staff for Gerald Ford, and he's just sort of been waiting for a president
despite his years of service in government, president to agree with him or go along with him on this sort of thing, and he now has found one. But I think that what I think a lot of people around Washington, around the country, misunderstand about the Cheney-Bush relationship is that Cheney is still very valuable to Bush with this core right wing in the Republican Party, the core conservatives. You look at Cheney's schedule, and he still talks to these people a lot. He still gives speeches to them and all. Now, internally, there's no doubt that his influence has waned. Condoleezza Rice's influence has increased on the diplomatic side of things, trying different approaches. So I don't think there's much doubt that his influence has decreased. However, as a player in the administration, you know, Bush is now in his public support in his polls. He's down to the hard core Republicans. He's now below 30% in some polls. That means that it's basically the conservative right that's still with him. And that's partly because Cheney is still very popular with these folks. And the war is still something that they support, and Bush's position. And I think the problem with looking at Cheney and Bush is that, in maybe in other circumstances, the vice president would have the president would want to dump him or something on this situation.
But he may be the last shield right there around that core support.
That's a very good way to put it. Cheney is really valuable to Bush with the conservatives in the party, and he really needs them. That's really all he's got going for him now. In political terms.
Ken, let me get one more call here, if I may. Paul in Concord, New Hampshire. Paul, you're on the air.
Hi. Thank you very much. This strikes me as sort of a weak bright spot in an empty calorie investigation. Just the fact that it's clear that Karl Rove was a source as well, and George Bush hasn't really been pressured to do what he said he would do, which is get anybody out of the White House that had anything to do with this. It strikes me that the investigation did not go far enough. I'm very chagrined to hear that Karl Rove was given these opportunities to correct his testimony. And he's still operating in the White House, granted in a diminished position now, and Cheney is still operating. It just strikes me that it could have gone a lot further. It should have. And I hope the media, somehow doesn't let the White House duck out of this technical argument that they can't comment because it's an ongoing legal issue.
But what do you actually expect, Paul? Does this all now flow into the 08 presidential debate, or is there something else that you expect before that?
I wish that somehow the Democrats would. It almost, to me, it mirrors the John Kerry convention in Boston in 04. When it was, let's not attack George Bush, let's be nice, and that ultimately backfired on John Kerry. And somehow I think the Democrats still have that mentality on Capitol Hill. When they have very real issues that they can pursue, and they're tap dancing around it a little bit, I think. I think it's almost a question of nerve. They're not quite sure of their footing. And when his popularity rating is so low and the Americans are seeing this administration and the mistakes they've made, it's somehow, I think that Democrats go a lot further now in really shining a light on the terrible decisions that have been made by this administration.
Paul,
thank you.
You're hoping. We hear that. Paul, thanks for your call. Jonathan Turley, final thought from you on where this verdict and the whole aura of politics and everything else around it now leave us in terms of executive power. Do you think we're going to look back on this administration as an outlier? We had an extraordinary circumstance in 9/11, extraordinary personality in Dick Cheney and the team with George Bush. Is this going to be a moment in time, or have we really put the presidency on a new, more powerful track here?
Well, I think that history will judge this administration harshly for what it has done, including what is, I think, pretty clear criminal conduct in some respects. But I think it will be harsh. But in terms of the executive power, they still remain committed to that. And Cheney's shop, if this trial showed anything, really was calling the shots within the White House. They were the center of gravity of the White House. And I think that we all are deluding ourselves when we say that people like Karl Rove and Cheney have been reduced in their authority. I mean, Cheney's actually curious about one as a figure in one respect, and that is he's so unpopular that he's the only guy who's standing next to the president makes the president look popular by comparison. I mean, it's sometimes good to have a lightning rod who throws red meat to the conservatives, and he serves that purpose. But I don't think that he is out of his influence. I think the president believes strongly in this absolute concept of executive power. And there lies many of the scandals that have come through this administration. This president has shown the framers are correct, that you cannot have absolute power in a government of shared powers.
Mm. One man convicted, but big questions still standing. Jonathan Turley at George Washington University, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Ken Walsh at U.S. News. Ken, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
And Jack, always good to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.